Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives, everyone. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, and we're welcoming you to this show, Shattered Lives, this evening. We're so excited to welcome you to this very unique show because we take you beyond the details of the crime and the perpetrator, and we get to the heart of what crime victim families experience and what they need in the aftermath of the crime. Prior to each show, please go to www.donnagore.com or imaginepublicity.com to read the background of the case or the organization featured each week before we go on the air. And please don't forget, if you can't tune in live from 5 to 6 p.m. on Saturdays Eastern Time, you can always listen on our archival feature. And our graphic for this show is denoted by a big red heart with a bunch of cracks. And within 24 hours, we hope to have a blog and the audio embedded for your future enjoyment. So, good evening again, and it's a sizzling hot Saturday here in Connecticut, as I believe it is elsewhere. And I'm very glad to have a very much in-demand guest this evening. I've been waiting for a few weeks to have him on. But before I get to him, let me make a couple of announcements. With regard to me, I want to let you know that we just came off of a very exciting, very enriching project last Thursday at the Henry Lee C. Forensic Institute at the University of New Haven, and that was just a stellar experience for all concerned. So we're getting that information up in the podcast, and we hope you go to it. And I want to let you know my future endeavors. I have many different skills that I can put into practice. If there's someone out there that will only answer the call, looking for alternate employment, full-time position, perhaps a program coordinator, manager, my primary focuses are writing, editing, my training in victimology and crime justice issues, event planning, motivational speaking, and dealing with oppressed populations such as the disabled, the elderly, the LGBT community. And those are just a few of the things I do. So please, please do take it seriously. Look at my website, and we'll talk, okay? And I want to introduce my co-pilot, my co-host, my good friend, my PR manager, Delilah Jones of Imagine Publicity, who does a stellar job. And thank you so much for being with me tonight. And I know this is one of the topics that is near and dear to your heart, Delilah.
Hi, Don. Yeah, it really is. I've worked kind of closely and loosely with a group here in South Carolina. We just recently got the governor to sign into law a stiffer human trafficking legislation that will, you know, be stiffer on the penalties for traffickers. It will also include asset forfeiture, which was something that we fought really long and hard for. It's very, very important to put a dent in their pocketbook. And if you don't, they just get out and start their business all up again. And I think, you know, as Ray will tell us in the show, this is a billion-dollar business. This is making more money for these traffickers than the drug sales, gun sales, anything out there, any type of crime. It's making more money. So we are able now, as soon as it goes into law in January, we'll be able to put a little dent in their pocketbooks here in South Carolina, and hopefully some other states will follow in too. And I also, you know, want to mention that I work very closely with another client of mine, Dottie Laster.
Right. Laster, I was going to mention that.
She has done tremendous work in fighting human trafficking on a lot of different levels. She created Laster Global Consulting, which is a consulting business, but she also is hands-on all the time. She does a lot with rescue and recovery and reintegration of the victims and finding places for them to relocate and all of that. She works very closely with the Bernardo Kohler Center, In fact, she is certified to practice immigration law through them. She's been trained and certified by the Department of Justice. She said she was in on the big task force creation that they had years ago, and she's also created organizations in both Texas and California and all over the country. She has people in place that, you know, can step right in and help with a case.
Wow, well, that's tremendous, and maybe I can put she and Ray together. I love to I love to connect people, you know.
Yeah, I do too.
So perhaps we can. Well, with that stellar endorsement of Dottie, who I've spoken with, Ray, welcome to Shattered Life. We're so pleased to have you this evening.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much, Donna.
Well, it's our pleasure, because ever since, I have to mention maybe just by starting out, ever since I attended the, shall we call it, experimental play in Hartford that is going to be based upon your book, that kind of really whet my appetite. And I did a blog on that. We haven't put it up yet, but we will, in terms of just how, if people have not read your book or do not have the time or whatnot, the play also has its place in creating its own message, doesn't it? Do you want to maybe talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I was approached by the Heartbeat Ensemble, a very devoted and professional theater company from Hartford, about a year ago.
Yeah.
And they build entirely new and original theatrical productions around social issues. And they
right.
really do it in order to spark discussion long after the play and the performance itself is done. So they approached me. They said, we want to do something on human trafficking. And one of their founders and scriptwriters, Deborah Wolf, said, is it okay if we use your book? And how will we do that? And what kind of agreement do we have to come to? And I said, just read the book and write the play. That's all you really need to do. And,
yeah.
They worked a long, long time on it. They have had two public readings of the script so far. They've gone, the response has been tremendous. And you're right. I mean, it's a long book, The Berlin Turnpike, and it's 500 pages long. It's very, very detailed. But here's something that a play or performances, you can be around other people, you can see the main points of how the crime of commercial sexual exploitation works in the United States. And that's the major theme of the book, is commercial sexual exploitation here in this nation. And they really have gone through the book over and over and over again and brought it to life in this theatrical production. So you're able to see, you're able to understand the concept of the issue, and it's a very complex one, in
right.
90 minutes, and then sit and discuss the different, you know, aspects of it, and it dispels the myths and the misconceptions around this crime, and there are so many. And
right.
that's really one of the reasons I wrote the book, was because I was so frustrated with the misconceptions that people have around what we call human trafficking as it
yeah.
is perpetrated here in the U.S.
Right.
Well,
let's
this would be a good time. You know, let the listening audience know some of these misconceptions, and let's give them a little lesson.
Sure.
Sure.
The first of which is that people, you know, they hear the term human trafficking, and because the laws were written, the federal laws are written, most of them, to see it as a crime that either happens outside of the United States, or if the victims are here in the United States, they're brought from outside the United States. And even the Trafficking in Victims Report, which is put out by the U.S. State Department every year, by law they have to do that, and they just released it 2 weeks ago, the 2012 report. And once again, it rates every country in the world, this report does, this, to how they're doing as far as human trafficking, battling it, including the United States. And it states very clearly the United States is a destination country for men, women, and children from Southeast Asia, from South America, from Eastern Europe, and it lists all these areas of the world where people are brought in from. It does not list the largest source country for victims of human trafficking in the United States, and that country is the United States. The vast majority of human trafficking victims are U.S. born and U.S. citizens. And it just, if you look at it from the eyes of the local pimp or the local trafficker, if you will, it
right.
certainly makes much more sense to go to the local high school or college or street corner or mall to find your victim than to go to Venezuela or Vietnam or Vienna. It's just easier to find them. So
mm-hmm.
that's one thing. Happens here, and the victims are from here. Another myth that we often hear is stolen people or kidnapped people. Yes, that does happen. And yes, that makes great headlines. And it puts fear in people, and it gets people to read newspaper articles and watch TV shows and give to nonprofit organizations. But the truth is, the vast majority of victims are not kidnapped. They're coerced into this, even romanced into this. And it kind of goes on and on in there. And one of the reasons I wrote the book and centered it on this federal case that took place 5 years ago right now in Hartford in June of 2007 was
right.
because it exemplified and illustrated every aspect of how this crime works in the U.S., including the fact that the girls were not from another country. They were from Vermont. They were from New Hampshire. They were from a mid-sized town in Connecticut in a high school there. And
right.
they were not kidnapped. In fact, one girl who was brought in into this stable of girls, if you will, that's what they call it, that's what the pimps call them, by her aunt. And when she was brought in, she went up to Vermont and got her friend to come down to Connecticut and work in it. So it's very incestuous and works in a very different way. It's actually much more devious than people realize because it's oftentimes people who know each other who sort of prime them.
Multi-generational, Ray?
And many times, yes. It's multi-generational. If you go to the Berlin Turnpike on YouTube and do a search for two girls, that's all you have to do is put in Berlin Turnpike and two girls. You'll see about a 10-minute video taken in Waterbury, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And there's two girls standing talking to their pimp on a summer night. And the one's about 12, one's about 13. And people constantly ask me, you know, and they pound their fists, where are their parents? I'm like, well, probably working the street corner up from them. You know, we're working on it. We have a generation now where their parents, their grandparents, their third or fourth generation of young people who are the product of no parenting skills. Their parents didn't really have much parenting skills, broken homes. Their grandparents, even their great-grandparents. So
mm-hmm.
you've got this destruction, really, of these parenting skills, this institutional loss, if you will. And when you throw in the dynamic of drugs and drug addiction and realize that when people are addicted to drugs, they will put everything after the priority of feeding that habit, even their children. So many, many times we had a mayor in Connecticut, a mayor, in fact, of that town, Waterbury, Connecticut, who
mm-hmm.
is now doing time in jail, decades in jail, because he paid a prostitute in in Waterbury
right.
to have sex with her daughter and her niece.
And her niece, I remember. Oh, disgusting.
Yeah. And that happens time and time again. The pimp is another girl. The pimp is a boyfriend, a husband, a mother, an uncle, or an acquaintance. And so this picture we have of a pimp, yes, that does happen. And in the case of Dennis Paris in the book, The Berlin Turnpike, that is the way it happened. But you also see behind him these relationships that were abused in order to bring more girls and recruit them into his web.
Right. Wow. Well, you know what it kind of reminds me of when you talk about multi-generational too is the people who, and I don't disparage people that need government assistance, but I'm just saying people who historically have been on welfare. And it's kind of the same thing, you know, okay, my grandma is on and we're on and they don't know another way of life and they just keep it going in that way, you know.
Yeah, it's true because they, even from their, you're again on a third or fourth generation who from the time they were able to understand and speak English or whatever language their household had, you know, there has been this prevailing attitude that, oh, it's the end of the month, we get our check and this is how
right.
our income happens. It's also, in many instances, replaced the need for the male. And so the male has sort of been, in many families, sort of ostracized. And in all kinds of cultures and heritages throughout the United States, young men aspire to be pimps. And now young women are aspiring to be pimps or even prostitutes. It has become more mainstream. We have now, of course, television shows glorifying pimpdom and prostitution, you know, whether they be scripted programs or reality shows, whether they take place in a brothel in Nevada, as in the case of Cat House on HBO, or The Secret Diary of a Call Girl, which is on Showtime. It's just this is a lifestyle choice, and it tends to downplay the hidden abuse that is covered up by this air of legitimacy. And so
what's the attraction for them in terms of, do they see it just as a means to an end to all this money, and they see that as glamour and that's it?
You mean for the girls to be recruited?
No, for people wanting to go in and be a pimp.
Oh, gosh, it's money and control and power.
Money and control
the ability, it's a status, it's control, it's quick money. And sometimes it's quick money just for drugs, and times it's quick money to build an empire. Or just it's literally their means of support. On the girl side, it gets a little bit more complex, of course, but it's really, you see many of the dynamics that you see in people wanting to be in a gang. It's inclusiveness.
Right.
It's being
right.
treated the way no one's ever treated them before. The one common denominator we find with victims, on the female side, of course, is that they have suffered some early sexual abuse in their life.
Right.
That seems to open up a door of vulnerability later on. And as they come of age, that need, that wanting, that damage is still there. If that's not answered, if that's not dealt with or healed, these pimps can see that wound in them from a mile away. They can see it in their eyes and their demeanor.
They're so vulnerable and naive.
Even though they may be acting very brash. But then again, if he romances her, if he woos her, if he acts like she's the most incredible thing he's ever met, and he takes her in as his girlfriend for a few weeks, and no one's ever treated like her that before. She's waited for somebody for so long, a male especially, to say these things to her, these wonderful, special, loving things, and to give her things. It becomes an intentional addiction between the girl and the personality of the pimp. She gets to the point where she actually believes she cannot survive without him. And
right.
So
and that, you brought that out in the play very, very, it was very obvious of that. And what I found very interesting, too, is that they lead this double life where they go home to a wife and children oftentimes. And they have all these women on the side, correct?
Well, yeah, it's not just a duplicity. It's more than just double. It's they leave the pimps, especially multiple
lives,
and especially in the case of Dennis Paris, who was tried in Hartford, and he's the focus of the book.
Yeah,
his brother Dennis Paris was arrested in 2006. He was tried in 2007. He was sentenced in 2008. His brother was arrested just last November. So 4 years, 4.5 years after the trial, his brother was arrested for the very same thing in Connecticut, operating out of the very same motels. Now, it gets really interesting when you discover, you look a little deeper, and his wife was his business partner. His wife recruited girls. She worked, as they called, dates as a prostitute herself. She would photograph the girls. His wife, during all this, was a Connecticut state trooper. So talk about a duplicitous lifestyle.
That's just incredible.
She's enforcing the law on one hand and breaking it in the most notorious and horrible way on the other. She would literally drive up to the motel rooms to bring the digital cameras to photograph these girls, to put them online, and that's where they're advertised now, in her patrol car, in uniform. So the arrogance of it is extraordinary. She's not a state trooper right now. She's being investigated, but she during this time she was an acting Connecticut state trooper. So
that's what I was going to say. Has she been prosecuted yet?
Neither have been prosecuted, but he has been arrested and is awaiting trial. She has no charges have been brought against her as yet.
Wow.
So and we really can't find out. I really haven't been able to find out what's happening with her. But, you know, go ahead.
Go ahead, Delilah.
This is just like a prime example of the whole grooming process as well. And
right.
And one thing that a lot of people don't realize is how many women are really put into that position as the groomer, because they're able to get, you know, get these girls especially to trust them and to, you know, they empathize with them. They're able to empathize with their vulnerabilities. And then there's also, I'd like for you to speak maybe about some of the different avenues that traffickers are finding these people. Like you said earlier, they're not just snagging them off the street, but they're advertising for employment in online and in newspaper. One area that we've seen a lot, and I'm sure you have too, is magazine sales. We've had a couple of cases.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they've been caught up in these magazine sales, and they transport them all over the country. They never know where they are.
Right. Right.
Yeah, they come up, the human traffickers, the recruiters, come up with different ways all the time. It depends on where you are in the country and what new system they're working. But to your first point, the advertising. You know, there are escort advertisements in print in every city in the nation through alternative newspapers. Most of which are owned by very large and reputable media corporations, conglomerates, really.
Right.
In Connecticut, for instance, we have the Hartford, New Haven,
Advocate, right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
In the back pages of those newspapers every week are escort advertisements. And Dennis Paris, again, in his trial, the Hartford Advocate was mentioned over 60 times. It was his sole and exclusive source of advertising the girls for what he called his escort business, except mm-hmm. that one was 14, one was 16, and they were selling sexual services. Now, they still run those advertisements today, and other companies, that's owned by the Hartford Courant, the oldest newspaper in the country.
In the country,
which is owned
right?
by the oldest one in the country, and which is owned by the Tribune Company, which is an enormous media conglomerate. So really, they're all profiting off of these advertisements that have been proven to be violations of human trafficking law.
Is there any way to crack down on these kind of advertisements, or to, like you say, to be a better watchdog about this? Or is it because the big corporations, they're just, you know, so profitable, they just turn a blind eye to it?
Well, if they were that profitable, they could probably let go. The problem is newspapers are not very profitable now, so they're trying to find income sources from everywhere they can get them, including this.
Including escort services, yeah.
Exactly. So this past legislative session in Connecticut, we worked to pass legislation that would make it more difficult for these people to advertise. And it's a start, and we're basically just not going to give up until we know that there's no one being abused through these advertisements. Now, that's your newspaper. When you go to the Internet, then the world explodes. See, there's so many dynamics now that have changed this business model. One detective in the Boston Police Department Human Trafficking Task Force said recently that the girl has become the new drug. And for bad guys who are getting out of prison or street crime, they're going into, you know, they're going into a, if you will, life of crime. They are using girls as their product or in their business model, if you will, instead of drugs. And it's more profitable, as you mentioned earlier in the show. It's far less risky, because if you get caught with your product and it's just girls instead of a car full of drugs, so what? You've just got girls with you. You do far less time. The penalties, the police don't know how to investigate the crimes as well as they do with drug crimes, of course. And you mentioned something else in the earlier part of the show about asset forfeiture. Drug crimes have asset forfeiture, but the police department gets the assets. In a human trafficking crime, if it's federally prosecuted, the victim gets the assets. So, you know, there's all these motivations for these criminals to move their business model over to selling girls instead of drugs. the biggest of which is using the internet, you can do so with complete anonymity, and you can do it globally. You can do it across languages, borders, cultural. No one has to drive around on a street corner, or a girl doesn't have to go out in rainy or cold weather and stand there and wait for cars to go by. It's become much more sophisticated, and they think much more clean, because you simply go online onto a service like Backpage.com, which is owned by Village Voice Media, another big conglomerate. You go to your particular town. You go to escorts. And, you know, today in Connecticut and Hartford, there's probably over 100 listings. And you simply go through the photos and make the call, and you can literally have a girl delivered to your home, your hotel room, within an hour, just like a pizza. Or you can go out and meet somewhere. So there's no, if you're new in town, if you don't know where to go, you know, a lot of people, men and women, they're not going to get in their car and drive to that bad part of the neighborhood. So they don't have to anymore. It doesn't matter what time of day it is. Well, I'm just saying it gives the both the John, the customer, and the pimp total anonymity in the business transaction. So the only one at risk really is the prostitute.
You know, it just seems like, you know, from their standpoint, such a perfect system. But, you know, we have to keep fighting against it. In terms of when somebody first starts out in this and they're naive enough to think that, oh, I'm just going to do this to, like, get a little money, how long does it take for them? When do they start the process to groom them? Is it after the first encounter that they have, or does it take longer, or does that depend?
Well, we have to remember that when they find a girl that they think is vulnerable to this, she it could be at various variable levels of, let's call it, ripeness. You know, she's or readiness. Some, if they're desperate to bail their boyfriend out of jail, like in the play, or if they're desperate to get a hit of heroin, they could go in a couple of hours. Marie, who's writes about her experiences in my book, from the time she met her pimp until her first date with a John was 4 hours. She met him, he photographed her, put her on Craigslist, the phone started ringing, and he got her to the first date in 4 hours. Now, she was very ready. Her boyfriend had been arrested. She was desperate for drugs. She wasn't quite sure where she was, and she was just that vulnerable. In other cases, if the girl's younger or just is enamored with a man and he wants to groom her a little bit more, maybe for high-end clients, or maybe he wants to get her more dependent on drugs or dependent on him, it may take 2 or 3 weeks. But he's really not going to spend much longer than that, and he's not going to spend much longer than certainly a month on just getting a girl ready. Why not? Why do that when you can find one who's ready in a few days or a week?
Right. I found a few paragraphs here in your book that seem to be very illuminating. I don't know if you would permit me to read a couple of paragraphs. It's called number 95. You Want to Die. It kind of maybe paints the picture, Ray, if it's okay if I read it. It says, I've heard every imaginable line, every imaginable promise Anita remembers. I love you. I'm going to marry you. I'm going to take you home to meet my mom. I'll never hit you again. We're not going to smoke crack anymore. You go out and make that money, and we're going to save it. And I would run out that door thinking, oh, my God, he's serious. The amount of money I was making, my God, I would have been so rich with the amount of money I was making as a prostitute. It's very confusing because you want to believe that what this person is saying is true. You want to believe that they love you and care about you, whatever they're promising to you, even if it's just that they're going to bring you to McDonald's for dinner because you worked so hard today. You really and truly want to believe that, and you don't want to upset him. You don't want to make him mad. So you go out and you trick some more, and you make some more money, and you get high. And before you know it, the money's gone, and they're mad, and you have to go out and do it all over again because you don't know what to do, and you just get used to it. And you do it over and over and over and over again. Every time you get out, you get a little worse off. Basically, every man I came in contact with out there was a very good talker. They told you what you wanted to hear. I was very weak. My self-worth was like negative 10. There's no boundaries when you're out on the street like that. It's not glamorous. It's not anything. You're cut down to absolutely zero. You're controlled. And when you have a problem to begin with, it makes it pretty much next to impossible to get out of yourself. You need somebody to help you, but you need somebody that's sincere. You don't just wake up one day and be like, okay, well, sobbing, okay, I love you. I love myself today, and I'm a good person today, and I'm just going to stop what I'm doing today because I believe in me. You don't believe in yourself. You want to die. There were times that I smoked so much crack that I couldn't understand, why am I not dead? Why am I still alive? I just wanted to die.
Yeah, and that was
from
Benita.
Isn't that riveting? Oh, my God.
That's incredible. And if anybody there, that interview is actually online. You can't see her face, but if, again, at the Berlin Turnpike on YouTube, and if you look up the word Danita with the Berlin Turnpike, you can see her actually saying that in that interview. They also lifted that for the play, The Project Turnpike, that exact monologue, and they didn't even write that part. They just took it word for word, and that is
in
the play.
I remember. Yes.
Yeah, and it worked so hard to that she was, Danita was so extraordinary explaining so many answers, so many questions people have about this, why and how, and it's a desperation. You just get so desperate for the next time or maybe this time, and you want to believe so much that you just do. And then you find yourself doing something that you would never imagine. And then, again, the destruction it does to the self, the inner self, your self-worth, after that's happened. You believe somebody, and they've taken advantage of you, and these men have taken advantage of you. She goes on to explain how she was treated by one John, beaten up by him, got away from him, ran into the street in the middle of the night, just stopped the car, all covered in blood and dirt, and the car she stopped just rolled down and said, you're just a prostitute. I could care less, and drove away. And that's the main reason I wrote this book, was because I kept seeing this dehumanization of the victims of this crime, and they just did not have a voice. And I wanted to really give them a voice, let people hear what their lives, what their experiences are truly like from without any filter.
Yeah. Well, you know, it certainly is remarkable, and I'm hoping that you're, as I hear you on NPR and other things, this is really becoming known throughout the nation as your book is serving as the vehicle. And is it doing well? How are things going with respect to the book being promoted and people being receptive to this?
Well, you know, it's funny. It's not like a Twilight series or the or 50 Shades of Grey.
Chicken soup for the soul, right? Yeah.
Right now, but it's actually on a steady increase as more people realize what it is and what it's trying to do, and word gets out about it more and more. And then, of course, the play being developed, and then there's some talk of a movie development.
Wow.
So it's actually kind of on the increase, and while all that's happening, you know, this is my second book on trafficking. My first was on child trafficking in all its forms around the world, called Unspeakable, and I'm working on a third called Supply Chains, about forced labor and how it works around the world, and how many of the products we buy are touched by either slave or forced or exploited labor.
Wow, that's really interesting. So you are really immersed and dedicated to this topic. That, you know, I'm looking at some of the other material you have here, one of the threads that I see is that besides the commercial sexual exploitation, you talk about the other major forms of trafficking, and well, some of them I thought I knew about, but I might have been surprised by a couple of them. The forced labor, the domestic servitude, and organ harvesting, those types of things. Can you talk a little bit on that topic, Ray?
On the organ harvesting?
the other forms of trafficking that maybe people don't normally associate it with, other than you know, the typical that you see on TV.
Right, and you know, again, the commercial sexual exploitation is a big part of the world of human trafficking, if you will. It gets the best headlines, it gets the most people watching, but really, the type of human trafficking that most people come closest to in their day-to-day lives is forced or exploitive labor in many of the manufacturing and products that we consume every day. And that means diamonds, chocolate, coffee, shrimp, clothing that we wear. And as we've heard over the past few months, even Apple Computers has had difficulty with its supply chains from its manufacturer and suppliers in China and some of the conditions in the factories there. So really forced labor is the largest dynamic of all human trafficking in the world. Within forced labor, though, outside of the manufacturer or agricultural forced labor, the large is really domestic servitude. And that means there's so many countries in the world where there's a huge disparity between very wealthy and very poor that oftentimes a family will say, we just can't feed this child of ours or these children, girl, boy, what have you. So they will send them off to a family in the city to be their house servant. And these children, you know, sometimes 8, 9 years old and even older, a little bit older, will get up before the family gets up, go to bed after the family goes to bed, and work constantly in between. They do the laundry. They get the clothes ready. They serve the kids. They might have a little mat to sleep on in the background. This happens all over the world. And, of course, when you have a child that's not a part of the family within the household, not able to leave the household, not getting any money, any kind of abuse can happen to that child and often does. So that's the aspects of forced labor. Outside of that, we have things like child soldiering, which is still predominant in Africa, where young boys and girls are, you know, it's far easier to get a 9 or 10 year old to do what you want them to do with a gun and kill people than it would be for someone who's 10 years older than that and knows right and wrong. Knows what the concept of murder is.
Yes.
But that's nothing new. I mean, when I give my talks to people around the country, I do a pretty in-depth presentation, and I show examples of child soldiering going back a long way. We all have seen the video, the footage, the film, of Hitler congratulating 12-year-old boys who were left to defend Berlin in the last days of World War II. Many young boys were fighting in the Civil War. And if we've seen Russell Crowe's movie, Master and Commander, there's young boys serving on those British ships in battle, you know, within battle, losing limbs. And that was typical back then. So that's nothing new. Still goes on. So we've got human trafficking. We've got forced labor, domestic servitude, and child soldiering.
Yeah.
But there
forced
are also others
like
forced marriage, which is big in some parts of the world where young brides are literally purchased. And then the organ harvesting. Remember, in some parts of the world, doctors who are able to perform surgery are civil servants. They're paid no more than any other civil servant, someone driving a taxi or a bus or something like that. But they have this life-saving skill. And if parents come along and say, listen, our child needs a new kidney or needs the surgery, and we'll pay you what is equivalent to maybe 1 or 2 years' salary for this doctor, he's probably not going to ask where the donated organs came from. But so that's another area we explore briefly in the book, but I explore more in my first book. So, yeah, it does not just stop with the sexual crimes. That's a big part of it, but it when you look at the studies that the United Nations have done, the U.S. State Department have done, the International Labor Organization have done, you realize that there are more enslaved people in the world today than ever before in human history, which is a tough fact for people to really grab onto because they think slavery was eradicated over 140 years ago. Well, legalized slavery was, but enslavement is bigger than ever before in all of these forms I just mentioned.
And why is it so difficult for supposedly more educated, enlightened workforce to to wrap their head around this issue. Is it just that, oh, it's uncomfortable, that I don't want to hear about that, so therefore it doesn't exist?
Yeah, there is a lot of head in the sanding on this one. I think a couple of reasons. It's just it tries to hide. By its nature, it's not easy to see. It tries to hide.
Mm-hmm.
And quite frankly, if we are able to go into a store and buy products that we need very inexpensively, nobody's really too eager to ask questions about how they got there, who made them, who picked the cotton for the pair of socks, who wove the, you know, who wove the material, and who put the sock together.
Wow, it is true. I think we take so much for granted about what we do have here. But you know, another interesting aspect of this is just historically the legislative piece and with regard to the 2000 TVP Act, and then other authorizations that have come along from 2003 up to 2008. Is that something you could share with us with regard to how far we've come since that initial act?
Sure. The initial Trafficking Victims Protection Act was built in the year 2000, about 12 years ago. And it was really a very cutting-edge legislation at the time. I'm not sure if the current legislative atmosphere could create such a law. But it was really in answer to this more international push that was going on, something called the Palermo Protocol, which had addressed human trafficking in the 1990s. And it was sort of America catching up with this new topic that many people were catching on to. However, it wasn't a new topic. There was what they used to call the white slavery sort of hysteria in the United States exactly 100 years ago. In fact, John D. Rockefeller, the oil magnate, commissioned a study called Commercialized Prostitution in New York City in 1912, exactly 100 years ago. Probably the last good study done on the problem. And the way they describe how it works in New York City then, in so many ways, it describes exactly how it works now. It's incredible.
Is that right?
And I cite it quite a bit in my book to show the dynamics on how nothing has changed. Now,
uh-huh.
Many people have heard of the Mann Act. The Mann Act was a piece of legislation back in the 1907 that was really pushed through the federal law very quickly. And it was a terrible law. And so the Trafficking Victims Protection Act really came to answer that question, how do we address human trafficking in the modern era? And within the law, it's a pretty good law to start with. It does address the problem as though it's a totally foreign problem or foreign-sourced problem, as I said earlier. It needs to and is beginning to look at the problem as an American-born problem as well. But you mentioned it was reauthorized as it has to be. It has to be reauthorized every 3 years. So it was reauthorized in 2003 and every 3 years subsequently, and was supposed to be reauthorized last year in 2011. But because of the highly charged political nature of Washington right now, it was not reauthorized. So this is the first time in its 12-year history that they did not refund it. They did a couple of stopgap measures, but it has not been rebuilt and reauthorized, and probably won't be until after the election. Myself and some colleagues have worked very, very hard. We've gone to Washington a number of times, met with so many congressional and Senate staff on both sides of the aisle to say, listen, this needs to happen, and here's a part of the law that needs to be addressed that isn't in there. And, you know, it's hard. They just kind of shrug and say, it's not going to happen. It's just, we can't
get
this done right
now. It's not your priority. That's very important. Is there a particular state that you can think of, Ray, that you think is just really in the forefront of this this issue? You had to think of all the 50 states.
That's a very good question. Washington just passed some interesting laws that have to do with Washington State.
Washington State? Yeah,
that has to do with the advertisements and trying to push back against websites like the Backpage.com. California has got some great ones. But because nobody really stands out as the standard. And here's the interesting thing. In 2008, they had a very progressive law on a federal level that they were going to reauthorize the Trafficking Victims Protection Act with. The mm-hmm. Department of Justice said, it's going to be a little bit too hard for us to enforce. And then the DOJ said, what we'll do is we'll write a model state law so that any state can come along, you take this template and pass a very comprehensive and very effective law for their individual state. Mm-hmm. And they did that. They wrote it. They let all the states have it. And since 2008, 50 states, no one has done that. Not one state.
Why?
Again, people do not understand the topic. You got to understand mm-hmm. what states have been going through since 2008. They're all going
right.
broke. So
right.
they're all trying to, while they're to them, they're sitting in a sinking boat and somebody's saying, well, what do we do about that problem we've got back on shore? It's like, well, we've got to save the sinking boat
yeah.
first. So
I understand that. It's going to be an uphill battle all the way. So every little piece like with what happened in South Carolina is just at least something you can build upon, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If you take all the state laws, the best state laws together and put them in one, you'd have a pretty comprehensive plan. We wrote a very comprehensive plan for Connecticut this past legislative session,
mm-hmm.
and they said, okay, this is great, but we've got how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. And,
right.
So it's kind of one section each year and try to go with it that way. Perhaps
right.
some state will come along, make this a priority and say, here, we're going to be the first. We're going to do this.
Hope it's our state, but we don't know. But we can only hope, And you know what I want to ask, Ray? We've got about 11 minutes or so left. Tell us a little bit about how did you feel about writing this book, being with the focus, having it beyond the Berlin Turnpike and the history? I mean, we really haven't talked too much about that in and of itself. You are from Connecticut originally, am I correct?
I sure am, and that's a good
right.
point. You do bring up a good point because, I realized that being from that area, knowing it very well, my father had a business on the Berlin Turnpike in the 60s. I knew it very well. I knew its dynamics, its history. And then this case came along that had, repercussions for the Berlin Turnpike. It also exemplifies so many roadways, commercial roadways outside of urban areas around the country. I mean, every city in America has a Berlin Turnpike. And for your listeners who don't know central Connecticut, the Berlin Turnpike is a very old commercial roadway. It's over 100 years old. It has Lowe's and Home Depot and Walmart and all the big box stores, 12 miles long. It goes from the southern part of Hartford, the capital of Connecticut, down to Meriden, Connecticut, a city about 12 miles to the south. It's virtually a straight line and was designed as such. And after World War II especially, it was really before the major highway systems began to be developed in the 50s during the Eisenhower administration, it was the only way to get from Boston to New York. And, of course, after the World War II, when the economy exploded and every commerce exploded and there were people traveling in their own cars on a mass scale for the first time, tens of thousands of cars a day went from down the Berlin Turnpike from Boston, New York, from Hartford to New York. And so motels started springing up so that salesmen could stay there, even families stayed there because there were all sorts of amusements on the road, nightclubs and petting zoos and ice cream places along the way, gas stations.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, for some reason, even though today there's all these big box stores, it's a typical, as I said, you'd see anybody driving down it would say, oh, yeah, we've got one just like this in our town. There are over 1,200 motel rooms.
They're still
on
there.
The
they are.
And
I
you
drive
look
by
at them,
it every day.
they've got the same signage they had in the 50s, and they've kept them. There's some of the most beautiful signs. They're ceramic and neon, gorgeous. In fact, the cover of the book is one of these signs.
That's right.
And it's not as though there's a lot of tourism in that area that you would have a demand for 1,200 motel rooms.
No.
So, one, in the book, we explore this trial, and we find out in the trial that Dennis Paris literally purchased two girls from another pimp for $600 each in a motel room on the Berlin Turnpike. So we really kind of show all the things that happen within those motel rooms and what still happens behind those closed doors that we drive by every day on our way to legitimate businesses. But I also use it as a metaphor for the Internet and how it works today. We go on the Internet for legitimate purposes, yet we surf past all these other websites where these things are going on. So really today, if you look at the Berlin Turnpike as a red light district, that red light district, that Berlin Turnpike, now we don't have to go there. It has come to us. It has come right into our homes, right into the computer that's sitting on our lap. And so that's really why I built the book around the Berlin Turnpike and its history, because it really explains how we got here.
Yeah, kind of a metaphor. Yeah, I see. Delilah, you have a couple other questions you'd like to ask?
Yeah, I think just, you know, kind of wrapping down to the end of it, what, in your opinion, what do you think would be the most important thing that, let's say, average citizens can do to help combat? I found that within our own state legislature, there were a lot of even legislators who really didn't have a grasp of what this problem is. They thought they did, but they really didn't. And that's one reason why it was so difficult to get the legislation through. But
it's true. They think it's a federal problem, so they think it's something the federal government has to deal with because they think it's a foreign problem. You're absolutely right. Local state legislators do not know, for the most part, the dynamics of how this problem is affecting people in their district or their area. And so I think you're going to ask, what do people do? Educate yourself as to how it really happens, what really is going on the Internet, even on Facebook. And I dedicate a lot of my book to the Facebook and how child pornography is proliferating on Facebook and the things we can do to stop that. And educate yourself and then educate your legislators, because if we put enough momentum behind that, they're not going to be able to ignore it as a problem anymore. They'll realize that it is, and they'll realize they have to do something about it.
Mm-hmm. Is this embraced in Connecticut by the permanent status on the commission on the permanent status for women? Is this something that they have taken up? Because let's face it, we generally have equality in a number of other areas, and I was just wondering.
They have the permanent commission on the status of women in Connecticut. Actually has a human trafficking task force.
Okay.
And they typically put out a report each year about what the state is doing to train other folks and as far as what's going on. But I don't know their long-term agenda with the issue at all.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't. You know, and of course their funding has been threatened so many times. They're often trying to walk a balance team and stay alive as
Totally understand that as a state employee. I do. You know, and
yeah.
You know. Wait, maybe I should have asked you this in the beginning, but Delilah and I were a little bit curious. How did you get, in the last 4.5 minutes or 5 minutes, how did you get involved in this personally as an issue?
Well, I used to do a lot of marketing and sort of communications, consulting work for large NGOs, nonprofits, churches, ministries. That did a great deal of work around the world. This is back in the 90s, so I did a lot of video production. I did a lot of writing and ghostwriting and did a lot of first websites for some of these organizations. And really, without even knowing what the terminology was or what to call it, we kept seeing this thing called human trafficking in different forms in Haiti and Israel and even in the United States. And then I saw it in New York, very blatantly a case of it in New York. We were doing a video, a little documentary about this wonderful foster mother in Brooklyn. And she had taken in through the city this 5-year-old girl named Karen, who was HIV positive. And we went over there, and just a little girl, she didn't speak very much. She was kind of small for her age. And the foster mother had to give her medication, which she took 3 times a day. So she plops her down on my lap, and the little girl looks up at me and with these very, very sad but hopeful eyes. And her mother gives her this sort of syrupy goo that goes down her throat, and that's her medication. And, you know, this little girl, as I said, HIV positive, she was rather advanced. She did not make it to her 7th birthday. Her mother was a crack addict and tried to sell her as an infant on the streets of New York for $200. So while I'm knowing all this, the foster mother looks at me and says, you know, she's one of the lucky ones. And I knew this little girl wasn't going to live much longer. She had this horrible disease. She had been born into this world that she didn't, wasn't her fault. And she's one of the lucky ones. And then the other city workers we spoke to said, yeah, this just happens every day. Every day
so this
here.
This kind of opened up Pandora's box for you and said, hey,
this is something I want to
get involved in. Right?
That was it for me, and I never looked back, and that was the end of it.
Well, we have to say we appreciate the fact that you're a champion of this issue. Can you please give us any contact information and how people might be able to get your book and any other information that would be important, especially we have a lot of crime victims and service providers that are listening today so that they can get the information?
Exactly, especially for the service providers. So it's so difficult to get services, especially for the adult victims of this crime, like Danita that you see online. Very difficult to get for us.
How did they get your book or get in
simply
touch with
the BerlinTurnpike.com or RaymondBouchard.com. And, of course, I'm on Facebook as well. So the Berlin Turnpike, Raymond Bouchard, or you can look for me on Facebook and say hi there as well.
And in the future will be the play. Right?
And in the future, there'll be project debuting in early 2013. And I can't wait. And it's just a great process to see what the Heartbeat Ensemble is doing with that material. They are really taking it and flying.
That's great. Well, I hope I wish you good luck in the progress of your latest book. Will you please keep in touch with me so that maybe we can have you on again in the future so you can give us an update?
Oh, you know I will. Thank you so much for having me, Donna. Thank you so much for your dedication to this. Thank you both. You guys are terrific, and you're doing a great, great service here for a population that needs.
No problem whatsoever.
It was an honor. It was wonderful to hear about this. Really.
Yes, and hopefully we can get you together with our colleague, Dottie, if possible, okay? Yeah, and I just want to say thank you, everyone, and please, I neglected to say, please go to mercymilano.com and curingcancer.me and try to help Susan with regard to with the medical donations if you can, buy her books, and please do remember to send your prayers and comments, and good evening, everyone. Thank you, Ray, and thank you, Delilah. We'll see you next week.
You're welcome. Have a great 4th of July.
Okay, you too. All righty.